Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we will be talking about good design and affordable housing, and perhaps generally about the problem of the lack of affordable housing for low-income people here in the United States. And we have as our guest an architect who has been working on this issue for a long time and perhaps is one of the best-known American architects working in this area. His name is Michael Piatok. He has relationships with a couple of different universities. He's professor of architecture at Arizona State University, also has a relationship with the University of Washington, although he's on leave from Washington right at the moment doing work at Arizona State. He also has a firm, Piatok Architects Incorporated, that's based in Oakland. As I said, this is an issue that he's been working in, an area he's been working in for a long time. So we'll talk about some of the basics and give people who are listening the opportunity to call in and ask questions. He is here, by the way, to take part in the 2006 Planning Institute here at the University of Illinois. It's hosted by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. Yesterday morning, we had a guest who was here for the conference, and we will again tomorrow have another. Macon Cowles, that will be the guest. He's an attorney from Boulder, and he's chair of the City of Boulder Planning Commission. So we'll talk a little bit about the issue of community planning. And questions here on the program are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. Appreciate
it. Perhaps we could talk a little bit kind of about the problem or the scope of the problem, because it certainly is a problem. That is quality housing, a decent kind of a place for families to live when they have limited means. It seems that's something in this country we have a real serious problem with.
Yeah, it's becoming a problem even for the middle class. I mean, real estate and housing is seen as an investment, and a lot of speculators out there using it for that purpose. And so the cost of housing keeps rising. But it's also treated as an investment for those who buy, so they have an interest in continuing to see it rise. So we have this built-in contradiction within our form of economy. It's a source of investment, but at the same time, it's an essential ingredient to survival. So what do we do about it? Back in 1937, the U.S. was the first time the federal government got involved in assisting people in getting their housing. And in 1949, Congress passed a law stating that it was a right. But it never really has been taken that seriously as an enterprise, government involvement in it in any case, to make up for where the market doesn't really function very well. So they've never really done a great job of it. They haven't kept ahead of the curve. And the quality of what was done back in the 40s, 50s, 60s was always done with a kind of punitive attitude. It was done begrudgingly. We're giving this housing to people because they're lazy. And there was an unwillingness to recognize that there's a basic contradiction in our economy that can't fulfill the needs of those who are paid at low wages. So we often have this conflict then between the primary employers who want to keep wages down so that they can compete now in a global market, and then the producers and sellers of housing who want to the highest price possible. So we have this internal contradiction within the capitalist system between those who produce, the primary producers, and then those who make housing. They're at odds with each other. Government, as I said, begrudgingly has stepped in to try to make up, to resolve the differences, but they haven't done a good job of it. In fact, if you look at housing policy, federal housing policy, there's well over $100 billion a year given in subsidies to the homeowners, in the form of, you know, their tax abatement for their mortgages and their local taxes. Renters don't get that benefit. And if you look at the amount of money that the federal government spends for low-income renters, it's a pittance compared to the hundreds of billions that are given to homeowners. And to make matters worse, 60% of that gift to homeowners goes to the top 20%. Because the bigger the house, the more costly the house, the bigger the deduction you can claim. So it's not a great picture from that bigger perspective. But then state by state, there are states that have made an effort to try to make up for that inadequacy. And you're beginning to see also in high-growth regions where the market is hyper-inflated, like the Bay Area or L.A. or San Diego or now Phoenix, Arizona, you'll see the business community, the primary employers, are stepping up to the plate and say, wait a minute, guys, the economic viability of this region is at stake if we don't have a lot of affordable housing for our workers. Of course, quite frankly, it's in their self-interest to put forth that argument. They recognize that these workers are going to be asking for higher and higher wages just to feed the local real estate market. And in the process, drive them, the primary employers, either out of the region or out of business. So we're getting an enlightened self-interest on the part of the big business community to begin to find ways or encourage ways of developing more affordable housing for their workers. Mm.
Is it impossible to make money if you're in the business of building either apartment buildings or single family houses or duplexes or whatever? If you're in the business of doing that, is it just not possible to make money and at the same time build the kind of units that either for people who need to rent and don't have a lot of money to spend, yeah, or the people who might be in a position to actually buy a piece of property, provided that it was an affordable house and affordable piece of property. Yeah. Is it just not possible to make money on that?
Well, yeah. If you look at the primary costs of making housing, land being one, cost of money being another, cost of materials, cost of labor, cost of land in those areas where affordable housing is really needed, the land tends to be higher. It's probably a more desirable region to be in. So land costs are high. Interest rates in recent times have been low, but that's a factor that has to be taken into account. And labor is constantly pushing for more because the cost of living goes up. So it's very hard to make it pencil out. Now, that's why the government at federal, state, and local levels has had to step in over the years and find ways of filling the gap between what it actually costs to build housing and what people can actually pay for it. And there have been various programs to help bridge that gap. It just can't really Every generation tries anew. They believe, the architects and engineers, for example, believe there's some technological bullet that will make our housing incredibly cheap and durable, and it can be done, built overnight, lots of schemes to do this, and it never really pans out. And even if there is a major technological breakthrough and you lower the cost of construction by 15%, all it takes is a 1% rise in the interest rate, and it wipes out all of those savings. You know, so it's just not really possible. We have to look at housing like we look at bridges and roads. This is part of the basic infrastructure of society, without which the society doesn't function properly. Mm-hmm. And we have to make that kind of financial commitment as a society to housing like we do to highways and bridges, period. Otherwise, if you keep making it a product solely governed by market forces, you'll have a quarter of the population struggling, paying 50% of their income or more just to put a roof over their head.
Yeah. This is, I suppose, a little bit of a different question, but I'm interested in how it is or whether, in fact, the industry, the housing industry, is thinking about or making an effort to respond to people who want something other than the McMansion. I think we're moving at a time where we know that there will be smaller families. We're all moving in a time where we know that probably we'll have more people in the older age groups that may have concerns about livability in terms of how the place functions, and people who are just interested in scaling down. They, mm-hmm, they want something that is comfortable, mm-hmm, and of a quality, and yet maybe something that's not all that much available. Mm-hmm. Are people thinking about that? And for example, if you were going to build a small house that was, you know, energy efficient, and it had some kind of contemporary amenities. I'm not, you know, talking about complete upscale luxury, but a nice small house that would, say, be comfortable for two mm-hmm. adults to live in. What would you be talking about now? What could you do?
Well, there are a number of developers and builders around the country who are fairly creative and looking for ways of making more compact homes and more compact communities as a whole instead of the sprawling communities with extensive infrastructure. They're looking for ways of making the savings. And this is a kind of technological, mechanical solution to the problem. It does certainly have an effect on your overall picture of housing expenses. If you include within that your utility bills and your transportation and commute costs, if you can actually locate closer in more affordably, you're saving on general housing expenses. So there are architects and developers out there experimenting with, and quite successfully, they're finding an untapped market, if you will, of folks who want to live somewhat scaled back, whether they're the empty nesters or pre-kid households. Those are probably the two ends of the spectrum of possible household types that can think about living in this manner. As soon as people have kids and the kids start having all the things that they feel they need, or at least the culture makes them feel they need, and they need the room just to run around, the growth in the house tends to take place. But even that doesn't necessarily, that's not necessarily a natural condition. I mean, I grew up in the tenements of Brooklyn where we had 600 square feet in our apartment. You know, in mm-hmm. fact, it was one room. And we all turned out pretty good. We had no play space outside. It was 100 units to the acre, so you played in the street. So even households with families don't need all the space that we've been led to believe we have to have. And oftentimes, even when we want to make more compact communities or more compact homes, it's difficult to do so because the bloatedness is encoded into our zoning laws, even into our building codes, that prevent us from making more experimental dwellings that are more diminutive in scale. We have, if you are doing any kind of housing that has any kind of public assistance, there's that do-gooder attitude that's set up a set of requirements to make sure that these folks were not being exploited and being forced into tiny shoeboxes. Well, that's a healthy attitude. That's good to protect people from exploitation. But on the other hand, they've built in standards now that seem to be a bit bloated. I just came back 2 days ago from a discussion with a client group that we're working with producing affordable homes down in Phoenix, first-time homebuyer housing. We were looking at a three-bedroom unit. And it was very important because these are going to be primarily for Hispanic families, that there be a bedroom with a bathroom on the ground floor for the grandparents or for the working son and daughter who yet can't afford their own apartment. Mm-hmm. So you may have three generations in a household. And then you got two more bedrooms or maybe three upstairs. And our impulse as architects was to put just one bathroom upstairs, maybe compartmentalize it, but just one bathroom. Well, the client, a do-gooder nonprofit, looked at this and said, oh, my God, the parents don't have their own bathroom. So they need their own bathroom, and then still another bathroom for the other two bedrooms, and then we still got a third bathroom. So now we've got a three-bathroom house. And I looked around the table, and I said, how many of you grew up in a house that had three bathrooms? Not a person. In fact, they all tell stories about we had only one bathroom, and you just got in line, and you made do, and life went on. Mm-hmm. So we got this creeping requirement that we have to have more and more. And we build it into the culture, we become more consumptive, and we can't make more compact living, which not only makes sense for low-income folks, it makes sense for all of us.
Yeah.
So we're chewing up the planet.
Well, it certainly seems, though, that while there is the interest in this kind of approach, more compact living, that makes sense for a variety of reasons, it certainly seems that the trend is still going in the other direction. For example, the town where I grew up, my mom still lives there, and we're seeing there what we're seeing a lot of other communities, where older homes are being, some of them even, you know, there's nothing particularly wrong with them, but they don't have contemporary amenities. Older homes are being torn down. Much larger houses are being built on the same lot. Mm-hmm. They have to seek variances from the city because they want to go against the required setbacks because they want to put the biggest house they can on the lot, and there are these big, very expensive new houses, and I'm sure that there are other places the same thing is happening. And if you can scrape the ground and start from the beginning, then you know you can build the biggest thing that you think that you can sell. Mm-hmm. So the trends still seem to be going in the other direction. And as much as you read in newspapers or in magazines about novel approaches to small homes and downscale living, we still seem mostly to be going the other way. And I guess what I wonder is that what happens, when does the tipping point come?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess when people just can't stand the hours they spend in traffic, the sprawl is making it more and more difficult for people to get to places of work. And in some cities, it's beginning to get to that tipping point. If we really felt the pinch and weren't immunized against it by indirect subsidies from the government, if we really paid the price of what it takes to get a gallon of gasoline, people may begin to think differently about it, or even food, the subsidies that are pumped into our agriculture and everything that we consume. We don't see the consequences of it. The consequences are somewhere else in the environment. They're either in the third world or in some remote location within our own country, so we don't see the impacts of it. But if we daily saw that and felt it, like those who use their cars should be the only ones expected then to pay for highways and bridges. Now, if that were true, and suddenly they had a threefold increase in what they had to contribute to the making of the infrastructure that only they are using, they'd probably think twice about the patterns of development that we're undertaking. But again, everyone is expected to pay for it, even when they're not using it.
Our guest, let me introduce again, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael Piatok. He's an architect. He has his own firm, Piatok Architects, in Oakland. He's also executive director of the Stardust Center for Affordable Homes and the Family. That's at Arizona State University, where he's professor of architecture. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana, the campus of the university, to take part in the 2006 Planning Institute, sponsored by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning here at the U of I. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So locally here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And anyplace else, you can hear us use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll-free line. We'll talk with him. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Michael, I have two questions for you. Can you recommend to the listeners a creative, enlightened either magazine or website that deals with the issues of low-income housing? And I have a second question.
Okay. I think a couple of possible answers to that. You know, HUD actually has a pretty good website. And lots of creative suggestions in there about development and about new technologies and about creative ways of changing local ordinances to improve the availability of affordable housing. So I would say, you know, go to the HUD website. And then in the private side, well, there's a great little magazine that comes out of New Mexico called the Designer Builder magazine. Great, great articles about various innovations occurring around the country for improving the way by which we are surviving on this planet. So I think that's a good private source and a good balance to what you might get from the federal HUD source.
Okay. My second question regards the issue of providing housing for people who have been released from jail. As an example, and I don't think it's limited to the Bloomington area, there is a jail overpopulation crisis. And as a social justice group here in town, we're trying to grapple with some remedy. And one of the things we've confronted is that there's no realistic housing for these people who are saddled with debt, and so forth. And as a corollary, I'm reminded of an article that I saw in the New York Times Magazine approximately 4 or 5 years ago, and it was a man and wife, Italian couple, who had moved to the New York, New Jersey area, and they saw these container, sea land container that you see on tractor trailers going across the country, and they did a proposal, and they actually stacked these in some kind of delightful configuration. And it occurred to me that if one took those side by side and just put a whole bunch of trusses on top, put a roof on, and had an overhang for a porch, and cut out with a cutting torch enough sidewall to put in some windows, you could have very reasonable, endurable type shelter. Of course, you'd have to deal with the zoning type mentality that you already mentioned. But do you know if anyone is doing anything along that line?
Yes, I know of some efforts in the state of Washington to use the shipping containers to create housing for migrant workers, because there's a similar situation. You have folks who come in seasonally to do some work, and then they're gone, and there's never enough housing, and they're living in pretty squalid conditions. And on the surface, one would say, oh, my God, how can a shipping container house their needs? Well, you've got your basic box with a little bit of insulation, as you say, also cutting in some windows. You've got some livable conditions for, you know, transitory period. So I don't think it's outlandish at all to begin with. But I think when you are dealing with recent releasees from incarceration, setting up settlements like that in any neighborhood could just continue the stigmatization of those folks. They're not really mainstreaming by living in what would be considered in most communities as an oddball condition out on the edge of town. So, I mean, that could have its problems as well. I'm working with a graduate student right now in Arizona who's looking at ways of integrating different populations together within the downtown area of Phoenix. These would be families who need affordable housing, but also families who can afford market rate housing, and build into both of those conditions, both the market rate and the affordable family housing, secondary units, little studio apartments. And automatically the homeowner then gets a bit of an additional income without too much additional expense in terms of the amount of stuff that got built for that accessory unit. And his idea is that local social service agencies who are dealing with folks who usually end up in these what are called SROs or single occupancy hotels, which can be either recent releasees or former substance abusers or folks who have very low incomes. They work at jobs that are barely at minimum wage and have difficulty finding housing. Well, they could become tenants in those little studio apartments in those family homes, with the proviso that within one or two blocks of that development, there is a social service agency with the necessary counselors so that the folks who are living in those studio units have that daily attention that's necessary in order to reconnect with society. They just can't be left on their own.
Right.
So it's a way of integrating them into society in a way that actually helps the new time homeowner. Getting that additional income can actually make it a little bit easier to meet those mortgage payments. And then that person is under circumstances, that individual is under circumstances where the behavioral controls are, while they're informal, they're more, in a sense, intense, because they're now surrounded by families who are expecting him or her to behave in certain ways. Rather than living in a hotel with another 100 people like himself, none of whom have understood how to survive within society for many years. So it's an interesting concept, as long as right nearby, on the same block or a block away, there's a social service agency that's providing the counselors that either the families who are subletting the rooms or the studios or the individuals using the studios can go to for assistance and advice.
Yeah, sounds terrific. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. We are at our midpoint here. We have some other calls we'll get to in just a moment. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Michael Piatak. He's an architect, has a firm, Piatak Architects Incorporated. They're based in Oakland. He is also the executive director of the Stardust Center for Affordable Homes and the Family. That's at it's Arizona State University, where he's professor of architecture. And he has been working for a long time in this field that we're talking about here, looking at the need for affordable
housing for people who have limited means. He's here visiting the campus. He's here for the 2006 Planning Institute, sponsored by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have several callers, and they're all here local. We'll start with Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just had a little comment. I really appreciate what has been said about how we all grew up in houses that were so much smaller. I know that I myself grew up in a four-room house with one bathroom with four people and in a four-people family, and really nothing was thought about it being so small or so little space. I certainly had a good quality of life in that home, and I think just that is really true that a certain amount of it is going to have to be educating ourselves as to, you know, what people really actually require, as opposed to, you know, just the concept of more and more space. As Americans, we just seem to be so wrapped up in, you know, having larger and larger homes. A large home that I actually lived in that reminded me of some of the stuff you're talking about, lower-income housing, was the two-deckers and three-deckers around in the Massachusetts area. And they were great affordable housing for, in terms of the amount of space and things that people got. One of the questions I always have about this is it more reasonable for people when they're trying to provide housing for to build something new or to try to rehab some of these older homes that seem to have been to be sort of overlooked in terms of possibilities for housing. Lots of times they're going begging.
Yeah, no, you bring up a good point. A lot of our older cities and towns have a terrific housing stock already there, and in many ways built more durably than what gets thrown up quickly these days, and they go unattended to for, you know, a host of reasons as a result of the flight from cities and the decades of disinvestment. But they are there waiting to be restored, and they are quite useful. The important thing, though, is that job base has to be created in their vicinity to create the demand to push them back into use. And oftentimes those were bigger, older homes as well that could be sensitively divided into smaller apartments to accommodate the young starter household who doesn't have any kids or the retiring household whose kids have gone. So you can actually get more households in the same amount of housing when previously there may have been only one. But you're right. All over the country, there are great examples of housing that was built prior to World War II that is going unattended and could easily be put back into use, good use.
Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Let's go to line number three. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm originally from the Berkeley, SF Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Berkeley. And I have a couple of questions about the economics of home ownership and lending practices in the U.S. I just wonder how much of the current price boom in real estate is related to the changes in lending practices that may have occurred towards the end of the 90s and early 2000s. It's my understanding that banks are now much more willing to lend more money to individual home buyers, that there was a rule. I guess it was as recent as 2001 or 2002, there was a rule that the banks wouldn't lend more money than it would take, say, 25% of your income to service the loan. It's my understanding that that's changed now, and they will loan you much more money than is, than 25% of your income would take to service it. And secondly, how much of the United States savings and investment is bound up in real estate investments, perhaps due to the above changes in banking practices. My suspicion is that there may be a substantial portion of the United States sort of economic resurgence after the dot-com crash may be related to changes in investments in real estate.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about how much of that?
Well, just to preface my comments on your questions, the first thing I'll say is I'm an architect, I'm not a developer, and I'm not a policy wonk. But I have learned about such things sort of indirectly by osmosis, by hanging around such people. But again, I'm primarily an architect. But I agree with you that in recent times, with the interest rates being somewhat on the lower side, money was cheaper, was more readily available. And a lot of it then got thrown into the housing market. And from my look at the numbers, though, the number of households that own their own homes in the United States has been stable for a couple of decades now. It's in the mid-60 percentile, about 65, 66, 67% at most own their own homes. And there's this consistent pattern of about 35% who are renters. So the additional monies that have been available in the housing market have not produced more homeowners. It's just produced bigger homes for those who could already afford homes. So it's just buying more stuff and not spreading the opportunity among more people.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, too, that a lot of the boom that if there is, if you can call it that, but a lot of the driving force of the economy right now is housing and everything that's related to it, because it's not just the houses. It's all the stuff that goes into the houses, the appliances, the furniture, the fixtures, whatever. That whole sector of our economy has been going strong because of the availability of less money. It's just not equitably distributed, and so we still have 35% who can't get access to ownership.
Right. Yeah, I'm just I'm worried that if the policy has changed to treat real estate ownership as an investment rather than as a necessity, that it's really not to the advantage of, you know, it's not economically advantageous to make housing available to less wealthy people, right? Because if you're busy treating it as an investment, the price has to keep going up and up and up. So,
well,
it's not fixable if we treat it as that.
Right, right. No, exactly. And this is, again, one of these built-in contradictions. Those who try to produce affordable housing for first-time homebuyers who can't participate in the market-driven housing market, they're faced with this dilemma. Should they build in deed restrictions so that the new owners can't sell their houses for what the market, you know, the profit margins of the market, so that those houses can also be affordable to the next set of owners that move into it? Or should they too be permitted to use this windfall that they've gotten, that is some kind of subsidy that made their house reachable for them? Are they then given the opportunity to put that out on the market in 5 years' time, let's say, and sell it for whatever the market will bear and use it as a wealth creation device? It's a lot of internal argument within the nonprofit sector, who are primarily the producers of first-time homeowner housing. A lot of internal debate. Should they be using these subsidies as a one-time subsidy only to one family who then can go on and join the market forces and play the game of real estate? Or should that subsidy be seen as something that should be passed on to every subsequent family so that what they've done is created an affordable housing unit that will always be affordable to future generations? It's not an easy answer to – it's not an easy question to answer, because – we're caught in this dilemma. If you make this housing available to somebody with a deed restriction that they can only sell it at a certain percentage of the rate of growth in the saleability or marketability of housing, you're also then slowing down their ability to jump into the private market.
Right. Yeah.
There's no easy answers to any of this.
You know,
and I think until the nation, as I said earlier, just sees housing as a critical piece of the infrastructure of society,
right,
and not as another commodity to be bought and sold to the highest bidder, until that time comes, we're going to be faced with this problem.
Yeah. One other aside relating to sea containers or shipping containers, mm-hmm. the previous caller mentioned, you might want to stop by a place in, I guess it's West Berkeley, called the Shipyard.
Mm-hmm.
Go take a look at that. It's a collection of shipping containers that are set up as a workspace for artists.
Mm-hmm.
They're not supposed to be living in them, as
right.
I understand it. But because they're supposedly not earthquake-proof, which
right.
is patently ridiculous.
Yeah.
You put these things on boats and put them out in hurricanes, right? I mean,
right.
they, you know, you bolt them together, it's what they're made for. But, I mean,
right.
you know, the laws don't allow it, so they're not supposed to be living in them. But it's an interesting assembly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're local to that. You should go check
yeah,
it out.
Yeah, I will. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We were
right.
talking a little bit earlier about, I think I asked this question about, you know, when does the tipping point come in terms of what people want or feel that they need in terms of housing? There seems that we must also be headed for some kind of economic tipping point, because it just seems that the direction that we're in, the trend that we're in terms of what's happened with cost of housing is simply not sustainable. It just can't keep going like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we may be reaching that tipping point as the cost of oil, the real cost of oil, has been hitting us. And there's more talk of miniaturizing our automobiles or shrinking them again. We have two sides to America. There's the SUVization, and all those who want that SUV feel they absolutely have it because they have kids. Kids need room when they're being driven around. Again, look back in the 50s, you know, or the 40s. How did they do it then? And then you've got another whole strain that's also equally American as apple pie. Let's do things more sensibly, more practically, and start miniaturizing our lives and our consumption patterns. The smaller car, the smaller house. So these two trends will be out there. Which one succeeds in the long run, I think, will be the result of how real do we begin to feel the pressures out there of what's really going on with the world's resources. And the more the defenses that immunize us against those impacts crumble, the more people will simply do the practical thing to survive, and they will scale back. It's getting rid of those elements of immunization, as I call it, mm-hmm. that are buffering us and drugging us into thinking that things are okay. Best example being, there is no global warming. You know, and that's coming right, you know, from right out of the White House. Mm-hmm. This guy's living in a dream world or in denial.
We have about 10, 15 minutes left to get in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Michael Pytok, he's an architect, has a firm in Oakland. He is also professor of architecture at Arizona State University, where he is executive director of the Stardust Center for Affordable Homes and the Family. If you'd like to find out more about what that's all about, you can go to the website at Arizona State and then go there. And if you have questions, comments, we'll get in as many people as we can in the time that remains. Next up is someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi, very interesting conversation today. I was thinking about my grandfather when he, like, I guess hundreds or thousands or millions of other people came back from World War II. He was able to buy very affordable housing, $10,000 as the story went, 700 square feet maybe, two bedrooms, one bathroom, very small, on a little piece of land. And I seem to recall that was a government-based program. So first of all, is that true? And second, there was clearly, you know, the aftermath of the war and a lot of prosperity, but it seems to me that the quote-unquote greatest generation was great partially because they had this whatever conditions existed to buy housing and start that road to financial security, and then, of course, other things like the GI Bill and so on and so forth. So was that a government program after World War II, and what do we need to do today to recreate that kind of circumstance where people bought very affordable housing, and it really made a major difference in the economy? And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Yeah, several good points there. Yes, after World War II, the country did take very seriously the debt it owed to those folks who fought in the war. And the very low interest loans were made available to make it easy for people to buy their own homes, and that was coupled with subsidizing the highways to get the roads out there to the suburbs, and it assisted then the builders who recognized that they could crank out these simple production homes, small in size, Levitt being a good example of it, small in size but yet expandable with expandable attics so that the starter family could easily get access to it, both because it was smaller, and secondly, it was on cheaper land because it was out of town, and thirdly, because the highways to get to it were being subsidized, and fourthly, the mortgages were being subsidized. So all of that came to focus on this one task, get these guys and their new families housed inexpensively. Now, there were a lot of consequences to that, not the least of which was the beginning of the draining of our inner cities, because people were led to believe that you have your more idyllic existence outside the city than within the city. So there was an anti-city bias in all these programs. And that began a flight. It happened to correspond at the same time that the federal government was subsidizing the production of agriculture down in the South and in the West. And that subsidizing the mechanization of our farms caused another 10 to 15 million African Americans to be thrown out of work in those agricultural regions, who then had only one choice, and that was to move north to our industrial centers. So at the same time that we were encouraging the flight of people from the cities, we had this additional pressure that we had, the government, again, in collusion with agribusiness, created in the displacement of the African-American populations out of the South into the northern industrial cities. And, you know, given the cultural state of our nation at the time, the white population, working class, blue-collar white population, was not ready for the cultural mix that was then being generated by these economic development policies. And so it just intensified the flight, the white flight, from those inner cities. And then a whole new generation of problems arose as a result of those great shifts of population. But, yeah, it's possible to reinstate these kinds of programs that make available on a much larger scale the low-interest mortgages, subsidized mortgages, subsidized down payments. But then again, we'd have to have a nation that takes seriously the debt it owes to those who are serving. And you know what's happening to even our veterans now as they come back from Iraq. The same is occurring as what happened after the Vietnam War. They're basically being ignored.
Well, let's go and talk to another caller here. Atlanta, not Georgia, but Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Real interesting discussion, one of my favorites. One of the questions I have is concerning, you know, the responsibility of architects, particularly, you know, or the challenge, I guess it's no responsibility, the challenge of architects today, particularly in affordable housing, is energy efficiency. There's, you know, instead of 3 bathrooms, why don't we go for really energy efficient homes, use that extra money, a lot of extra money that's used for things that really don't make a lot of difference, to really make homes energy efficient, which, you know, I've been listening pretty close today, and I haven't heard much talked about that, but that's, you know, energy efficiency costs a little bit more money, or maybe a lot more money, but it seems with good thought in the way of architects, we could develop some affordable homes that as we build them, they might not be a whole lot more money, but in the long run, people that occupy these homes, the energy efficient part of it is almost going to be as important in the future as the initial cost of the home. So what do you think about those ideas?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And what's been encouraging about working with the nonprofit developers, this is a very high priority for them, long-term operating expenses for the residents, whether they be tenants or homeowners. And they're pushing hard to get whatever housing they produce to be more quote-unquote green. That is, the materials that are used have less of an impact on the environment when they're being produced or when they're being consumed or even when they get discarded. And then at the same time, the dwellings, when they're in operation, are using less and less electricity, so that by making them more dependent on, more useful of natural daylight, and also insulated well enough that they are not having to spend a lot on heat and air conditioning. One of the tragedies of the Phoenix area is that the housing industry there is addicted to wood frame stud construction, which is ludicrous in a desert environment. They should be building with masonry, thick masonry walls. so that those buildings have mass, and not only insulation but mass, to help retard the process of heat gain when they don't want the heat and retard the process of heat loss when they want it to contain it within the house. And they're not doing that. They're not using masonry. And there are some new masonry products out there that are made of fly ash concrete, which is really a waste product from coal plants, and it's aerated. And you get a concrete block that's about one quarter the weight of normal concrete, but it's a much, much more insulated block and terrific then for use in desert climates. And in fact, our center just built a house in the Navajo Nation using that material, and it's a Navajo Nation plant that is producing it. And they could be selling that throughout the Southwest if the building industry would open its eyes to the consumer's concern about long-term energy expenses. So I think there are shifts that are occurring out there little by little. You do see these innovations occurring. The builders are recognizing that it isn't a priority to the buyer, and they are looking for ways of making things, quote-unquote, a bit more green, at least at the homestead. They're still not thinking green in the neighborhood patterning. They're still sprawling at 3 units to the acre instead of building at 20 to the acre closer into the job base. But at least they're trying at the dwelling scale to reduce energy expenditures.
Well, that's pretty interesting. And, you know, as an architect, I would, you know, me not being one, you being one, I envy your position, the fact to work on these kind of challenges, because in the long term, that's going to really be important. So thanks
yeah,
a lot.
Thank
for your
you.
Work.
It is fun being an architect. It beats working for a living.
You just touched on something, and it occurred to me that earlier we were talking about the difficulty in developing affordable housing. Part of it has to do with the land cost, mm-hmm. and you would think that, well, the way that you deal with that, that you're going to have to deal with that is by increasing density, which I'm sure brings problems with it there, all kinds of problems. But is do you think that's actually something that's going to have to happen?
Yeah. There is a cultural shift occurring in this domain as well for Americans. We are used to spreading ourselves out. We thought we had infinite land available to us. But if you go back to our early beginnings and you look at how colonists settled, they were very tight, compact communities out of necessity. They couldn't afford to sprawl around the landscape. They had to be close together to save on the time it would take to get between things, also to save on materials and the amount of road work they would have to make, and also for defensive reasons. And the same was true with the pioneers. Well, the pioneers, of course, did spread out in terms of farming, but they made very tight, compact, small towns to service the agricultural regions. And their dwellings were small, compact dwellings. So, you know, again, in those circumstances, you understand, you feel daily the limitations of your environment, and so you respond intelligently to those conditions. We've been immunized. We've been exploiting the rest of the world in making our patterns of living here in the U.S., and so we think we have this endless supply of everything. But it really is not the case. And so you have folks who have grown accustomed to not touching their neighbors, their dwellings not touching their neighbors, or not seeing their neighbors, or living in one-story houses in the Phoenix area. The idea of making a two-story house is a cultural shock, because that means your neighbor might be able to look down into your backyard. You know, heavens. But people in the East have, that was the pattern from the beginning, and you live with it. So like I said, there are multiple strains to the American psyche. One is, I don't want to see my neighbor. One is, I love to be right next door, right on top of the communal aspect of living, is also a high ingredient in the American way of doing things. So I have I have an optimistic belief that we will drift back towards recognizing that we have to begin to put our arms around each other again and stand around in a circle, rather than trying to see how far apart we can get from each other. It just doesn't work anymore. Yeah. It's just going to cost too much.
We'll see if we can real quick get one more caller. Belgium, nearby community, line one. Hello.
Yes. I'd like to point out a rather unique situation here located on the east central portion of Illinois. I live very close to a small town named Danville, and Danville has a very, very low housing cost right here, because we were part of the Rust Belt, and during the downturn in the Rust Belt, They exported a lot of jobs away. Now there's lots of houses that sit empty or go for much lower cost. In the Champaign-Urbana area, your average house might cost $200,000. Over here, it costs $78,000. Considerable difference, but nobody seems to want to move into them and utilize this area where it's got an advantage. I know out in the Bay Area, that's probably, you won't find a community like that. But here, it's a rather unique situation. Do you know of other things like that, or is there a way to solve this problem?
Yeah. You mentioned it early on, what the problem was, the jobs left.
They went to Mexico or right. Southeast Asia right. or someplace like that.
Right. And then the question is, how can jobs be either brought back, or where is the closest job base? Is it within an easy commute distance? That might reactivate those communities if people recognize that maybe for just a half an hour commute, it might not be so bad. And commute today, there are a lot of ways of commuting, even without transit. The whole idea of car sharing is beginning to catch on, at least in urban areas, and it's gotten quite sophisticated. There are some people in my own office in the Bay Area who don't have cars and they use such systems. They're very sophisticated. You can have the car reserved for when you need it. It's programmed to just respond to you if that's your time slot to use that car. And they're all energy-efficient cars. A lot of them are hybrids. So even if you're a half hour out from the main job corps, there are ways of handling that commute without having to pollute the air and without burdening people with having to own their own personal vehicle. A thoughtful strategy of transportation, if that town that you mentioned is within a half an hour or even 45-minute shot of a vibrant job center, an intelligent, carefully, sensitively designed transportation system could get people back and forth without too much effort or cost. That would help reactivate that community and get that housing stock back in use.
Yeah. Sorry to jump in on you like that, but we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time, and I'm sorry we have somebody else we
sure.
can't take. We're going to have to leave it at that. With our thanks to our guest, Michael Piatak. He's an architect. His firm is in Oakland, California. He's also professor of architecture at Arizona State University, where he is executive director of the Stardust Center for Affordable Homes and the Family. And he's here visiting to take part in the 2006 Planning Institute, sponsored by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Support for the show comes from the Infant Parent Institute. With offices in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Support also comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series at 4 o'clock on Friday in room 228 of the Natural History Building, 1301 West Green Street. The Illinois Geological Survey is presenting a public lecture titled Snowball Earth, Science or Snow Job by Dr. Paul F. Hoffman. He's professor of geology at Harvard University. We will take a break. In the next hour, we'll talk with writer Andrei Codrescu. First, though, we'll have news and update on the market. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets, where Chicago Board of Trade soybean futures turned around this morning following the strength in soy meal on what traders say is a technical rebound. Looking at the current charts in the November beans, now trading above both the